Live. Catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
Last week we started our conversation around the Bella Act, and we just wanted to unpack it all. And you know, we just thought it's important for us to know exactly what people are talking about. So this Mbizo continues today as we continue our conversation. We'll recap a little bit, but let's bring again our guest, Equal Education General Secretary Nongleto Matubetube, who is on the line again with us. Thank you so much, Nongleto, for agreeing to come back. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening, and good evening to everyone listening. I'm really excited to be back. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to do this again.
Thank you. Just a quick recap. We were just going through what it is that we spoke about last week, and one of the main issues that you highlighted last week was the issue of language. You spoke a little bit also about the SGBs, how the school governing bodies are going to have to adjust, and how you see that adjustment taking place.
Yeah, so the clause that speaks about both admissions to schools and the language of schools is in fact what we call a progressive law reform. Because what we're talking about here, when we talk about Bella, for everyone listening, is we're talking about the Basic Education Laws Act. Mm-hmm. So it is the law that will govern the how schools respond to the day-to-day running of those communities. And so one of the clauses that is in the bill, highly contested at the moment, is one that says, we want to be able to encourage the law, schools, the education system, to enhance the oversight role of the head of department in each province. So a province will have an MEC of education, as we know, but it will also have someone called the head of department. The head of department, we're asking for further or enhanced oversight, because that is an appointed person in government that is responsible for the running of schools across different facets. And we're saying that the HOD, in order to make sure this reform progressively responds to what South Africa looks like today, our schools are as grossly unequal as our society. The HOD should be able to support school governing bodies, right? We're not taking away the powers of the school governing bodies here. We're insisting that they become a head of province that is able to oversee the admissions policies of schools and the language policies of schools. The reason for this is because as South Africa's demographics has shifted and changed in the last 30 years, in response to growing inequalities in our society, we're finding that schools aren't necessarily appreciating and responding to the changing demographic of the school community. What does that mean? It means if you speak a certain language and you stay in a certain environment or community, you should be able to go to a school that can offer you that language by medium of instruction and as a subject offering. The types of schools here that are feeling threatened by this reform are the types of schools that are able to say, we will only offer Afrikaans and or English as an example.
As our tradition, and we'll hold on to that tradition.
So in a way, it becomes an exclusionary measure. And that's what we've watched in the system over the last 15 years, at least. Connected to this clause is the idea that school admissions should also be overseen by the head of department. Because we're finding that while schools typically in poorly resourced environments or communities, township schools, rural schools, will have an intensely overcrowded classroom situation across the board, across grades, okay? And we know that you can't get conducive teaching and learning to happen in an overcrowded classroom. And that's become the status quo in our schools. While government is saying to us, we need to adopt an austerity, fiscal consolidation agenda, there isn't enough money to spend on social goods, we need to be paying for Eskom, the running and upkeep of Transnet and all of those things, they're taking money away from budgets that are meant to service education, for example, health, housing and so forth. And so we all know that we're in this precarious situation. Government has made their own political choice about this. So with the money that is left, governments, I think 2 weeks ago now, the government, the Department of Education in Gauteng, for example, put out a public statement that said, we know we have a school admissions crisis in this province, but we aren't in a position to hire more teachers or build more schools or classrooms. So there is no commitment or political will from government right now to increase the capacity of schools and the personnel that administer teaching and learning. So what the bill is suggesting in law as a reform agenda is that some of the schools that are able to hold admissions policies that say we will only have 35 children or some 25, 28 children in a school will have to then reckon with that decision from the school governing body with the head of department. The head of department has the responsibility then by law to serve all children in South Africa. Okay. And they're going to be in a position to say, we see that your school over there has the capacity to hold 1,000 learners, but you are now sitting at 780, for example. And while a school down the road is oversubscribed, which is the language that they use in the departments, can some of those learners be moved to a school to make sure that all schools are carrying similar capacity, sharing the resources that are available, creatively using very progressive law to make sure that the right to basic education for equal and quality education is afforded to all children, regardless of what they look like or where they come from.
I mean, it's an important point that you're making, because one must understand that fine balance, that yes, it's very, very good for school governing bodies to have this autonomy, but yes, there needs to be oversight. Everybody needs to be seen. You know, we need to check what schools are doing, even as we give them the freedom to manage the schools themselves. I just want us to go now. We touched also on the criminality of parents who, for instance, and you were very strong on this one last time, who would be criminalized if, for instance, a student is not at school. And there are many, many reasons you pointed out that sometimes render the children, you know, sitting at home rather than being at school, and that we need to be considering that rather than criminalizing the parents.
Absolutely. We must be very careful, collectively, please, to everyone living in South Africa and listening to this show today. We need to be very careful of a democratic government that chooses to introduce laws that criminalize poor and working class people.
Yeah.
It's 2024. We're seeing many other things that confirm that our government is neoliberal and is regressing on progressive human rights. But on this account, on the Bella Act now, because it has been signed, it's no longer a bill for people that are listening. In the Bella Act, what they've suggested is that if children are out of school, your parent, the guardian or parent of that child, can be sent to jail for a period of 6 to 12 months. And what we're arguing is that there isn't a black parent, black or brown parent, or someone that has less resources than they need would choose to have their child out of school. And so we are wanting government to think creatively. There should be an interdepartmental, interministerial, all words that shake our government officials' boots every time they hear collaboration with each other, please, because that is your job. We're looking for interministerial coordination from social security clusters. Instead of criminalizing a parent, you must be asking the questions and making immediate interventions to support the reason and rationale for that child being out of school.
And I mean, and these are basic things. I mean, you mentioned it as just on a practical level, these are basic things. Sometimes a school that is X number of kilometers away, scholar transport is no longer available, and we haven't come in to sort that out, as we know that the parents in that community cannot afford it. But, you know, nobody picks up on that. And then therefore you end up with a parent who's criminalized rather than dealing with the scholar transport, for instance.
I want to give an example of this, okay? The Western Cape has the highest number of children outside of school in 2024. But the Western Cape is also challenging Equal Education and Equal Education Law Center, plus other actors in sort of social justice on education issues, challenging us because we've brought a case to them that has said, there are too many children outside of school. This is an infringement of the right to basic education. Can you please put all of these children in school immediately, And then the second part of this court case asks the department to please put together a comprehensive plan that shows how the province will deal with the school admissions crisis. Because every single year, our offices are inundated with parents and children who have not been placed.
Yeah.
We've now learned that the same reality exists for children and parents in Gauteng. Now, these are urban centers, and we can understand why, with the rate of migration, that this is where this experience is prevalent.
Mm.
But if you've got a government that is experiencing budget cuts, and you've got a government in urban provinces that is experiencing an inability to deal with the insurgence of people, and therefore has a school admissions crisis, and you're fighting the possibility and the potential of working together with the sector to put together a plan, you're bound to have children out of school by your own creation and design.
Mm.
And in fact, carelessness. So that's one part of the story, just to layer this conversation. Mm. The second is, you're absolutely right, the consideration around scholar transport. In KwaZulu-Natal, we've had to go through years of campaigning with the education department to convince them that there's layers of issues that affect children on the journey to and from school,
mm.
especially in rural provinces. Sexual assault, climate shocks, distance, fatigue, all sorts of things that mean by the time a child has walked 4 kilometers to get to school, they simply can't participate in the teaching and learning environment.
Mm.
And what happens now as budgets get cut is that provinces, they've got top 3 items that they're letting go of. They're freezing vacancies in the departments of the officials and freezing vacancies of teachers.
Mm.
So you get less and less teachers in the system.
Mm.
The second is what we call LTSM. Those are learning and teaching support materials, textbooks, printing papers, stationery, you name it. Those line items are shaved off by our government officials. The parents must subsidize, bring a TAPEX or whatever it is that you can to support your child being in school.
Yeah.
And the third is scholar transport. We've recently had to go into a difficult conversation with the Department of Education, not just in KZN, but also in the Eastern Cape. Rural provinces that typically are sending money back to National Treasury because it has been unspent are also now going, we're too constrained with how big the system is.
Mm.
And in order to save money, we're going to have to cut learner transport. Now, if those kids can't get to school because ayikho ibhasi or a taxi or a small car, it means that their parents are likely to be
imprisoned. I mean, in real terms. And that's such a big concern, because when we unpack it that way and understand that not every parent whose child is not at school is irresponsible, didn't want their child to go to school, and that, you know, some of us are more privileged than in other communities. The proximity to school, for instance, you may have a car, there may be more transport, you may have the means to take your child to school, all of those things not taken into account. I want us to talk about making grade R compulsory. As I've seen, quite a contentious one. I've got my thoughts on it, but let's just maybe hear from you first.
So we accept this idea of making grade R compulsory. And I must also just say that when people are looking at the literacy and numeracy crisis in South Africa, we know the famous stat now from Pearls that 81% of learners in the fourth grade in South Africa cannot read for meaning.
Mm.
We also know that about 23% of learners that leave grade one cannot sound or comprehend the full alphabet.
Yeah.
Which means that the foundation phase of our education system is standing on very shaky ground.
Mm.
There's a crisis of literacy and numeracy at foundation phase. And so it trickles into the rest of the academic period of children. And so part of what people have said is that academics, people that have done sound research in these matters, have said to us, part of the problem here is that, now I want, this is the context I'm setting first. About 60% of children in South Africa are living in homes that are grappling with poverty and hunger.
Yeah.
And so those children go into the schooling environment, most likely the first time that these children interact with a formal teaching and learning environment is in grade R.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, is in grade one.
Grade one currently, yes.
And so they're playing catch up with children that have had the privilege of being inside some kind of quasi-formal early childhood center, grade R formation that is connected to a big school, in inverted commas, and so have a different kind of experience that lets them flourish then in grade one. And so the introduction of grade R as compulsory attaches that level, that 6-5-year-old learner, regardless of where they come from, what they look like, to a formal schooling environment that already has the infrastructure and the know-how and capacity to make sure that they're ready to start school in grade one. And that is a progressive policy reform. It is necessary to deal with the foundation phase crisis. The trouble, the reason this has become controversial, and this is where sometimes we need to also just think a lot about misinformation and the types of regressive forces that occupy our media spaces, TV and all that. Because sometimes I don't know if they're thinking things all the way through in the guise of privilege. So folks are saying to us, yeah, but if the system is already overburdened, why then add on this kind of law? And we're saying, of course, the system is overburdened and there are systemic things that need to happen there, okay? We need to make sure that there are enough schools for the amount of children in South Africa, for one example. That's where the admission story comes in. But in this case, what we're arguing is that put the law into Bella so that it governs the way that the department plans, allocates budget, so forth and so on. But let's consider a phased approach. Let's let governments go off and talk to us about how many learners will you be accommodating year on year? And that will also help us build advocacy and rational, good reason on how we approach National Treasury for additional funds to support this kind of incubation. And this is another thing that could also integrate the social security cluster. How is social development helping to make sure these grade R's are in fact in school? And that's the rationale that we're fighting for. It's true, the system is overburdened, but this is a necessary reform if we want to improve education in our lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, and then there's been quite a lot of conversations in recent times about how there has always been this crazy focus on matric results in South Africa and this obsession with matric results when actually we should be dealing with foundation phase. Because once you lose a child at that level, very, very difficult to catch a child up to deliver. And then we complain about the quality of education. But if we don't do it sooner at foundation level, at grade R level, you know, we then sit with the kind of stats that you were referring to, you know, 10-year-olds, grade fours, who are not reading for meaning, which is, I mean, when you look at us in relation to the globe, it's quite scary that we are sitting where we are right now with that kind of a scenario.
We're absolutely at the bottom of the barrel. The polls results are a global and international benchmark, and we come off last. But we still have a functioning democracy with a huge amount of money that's allocated to the education system. And if people are interested in supporting progressive policy reform, the conversation we should be having now is how and how can we help across sectors, regardless of where you work and or operate space. If we're interested in truly going exactly to where the problems lie at a foundation phase inside of our schooling system.
We did touch a little bit on home education regulations, and you gave us some really scary examples last time, I think, of we now need to regulate what is homeschooling and where homeschooling takes place. These we are told of these centers that sort of prop up what would be like a little 10 student kind of setup and someone calling it homeschooling, whereas actually nobody's regulating it and other inappropriate things going on there rather than teaching.
So I don't know if I shared last time, but this was funny, but we laugh because we can't always cry. The majority of folks that attended the public hearings, so what happens when a law is being changed or introduced is that Parliament will take it into communities and host things called public hearings across the 9 provinces. And there the general public, you and I, can come in and say, we're happy with this part of the law, clause XY, infringes on my rights, constitutional rights in these and these ways, so that Parliament gets to hear firsthand the reception of these changes from people, because that's the work of democracy. The majority of people that attended those public hearings, outside of organized unions and that kind of thing, were predominantly white parents, and I hope I can say that quite candidly, yeah, because we're Rainbow Nation and all those things. But the majority of folks attending those public hearings were parents arguing for homeschooling. Now, this is another myth about this act. The act is not proposing that there should be a clamp down on homeschooling. What the act is proposing is that all folks that are going to keep their children at home for learning should at least register their intention to do so. The census says we've got X amount of children in South Africa, then we know that X amount of those are in public education system, in ordinary schools, XYZ, a certain amount of those have prescribed themselves to a private school, and then this proportion of those children are inside homeschools. That's what government is looking to understand. The second thing that's been proposed in that clause is that they're saying from time to time, we're gonna, when you register, you need to be able to tell us what model are you using to teach your children. Now, this is fundamental. Children's rights are the most poorly held across the world. But you can't imagine what it looks like to abuse a child's rights in a society as unequal as South Africa. And so for us, it's extremely important for government, the institutions that are meant to promote and protect and safeguard the rights of children, to have a clear, concise, super comprehensive understanding of where children are at and what they're doing at all times. So that is why we insist that as you register, you have to lay down what exactly it is that you're teaching inside of your homeschool.
Yeah.
And then we're saying there has to be also some level of quality assurance. We have to make sure that wherever your child is, you're homeschooling them, you've developed some kind of model, or you've adopted one from elsewhere that was really inspirational to you. That's great. But can we make sure that when they leave the homeschooling environment, they can integrate into society and into whichever part that they choose for themselves as young adults? But have the necessary grounding and education to help them flourish in those ways. And that's also a part of protecting children's rights. It is in no way trying to clamp down on that approach. But I think what is going on, and this is now not equal education, but my own sort of having been in a few of these public hearings, it is so easy for privileged South Africans to choose to opt out of government services because of the status of our country. You get your own solar, you get a borehole, you got your own
security,
water,
everything.
X, Y, and Z. Maybe you grow your own food, I don't know. And then you're choosing to keep your child at home because you understand how to teach them best. And while that's fine, because we all have the right to do those things, there has to be some kind of appreciation of a governing law that is applicable to every single South African. And here, we sometimes make, when I say we, I'm talking about civil society in general, interested persons. We make these interventions because we're not thinking about the well-meaning group of parents in the north of Johannesburg. We're thinking about worst case scenarios of children and parents being taken advantage of and the state not being able to play its role in protecting children.
Let's talk about the law itself now being criticized by disability groups, and they criticize it because they're saying that it does not prohibit the exclusion of learners with disabilities from admission to public schools. Just maybe unpack that for us.
This is the thing with law that's very important to always remember. It's that it's an instrument, and the way that it comes to life depends on how we exercise it. And so we must be very involved in these conversations, which is why I'm glad we're having this chat today. The current act, it almost assumes that when we talk about access to quality basic education, as it's trying to purport for us, that this includes learners that are differently able or with special needs. And the reason I think I want to call them pressure groups, but I should. But the reason different organizations and interested people are arguing against the act is because it doesn't say enough explicitly around the promotion, the safeguarding, protection, and enhancement of rights and facilities and infrastructure and resources for children that are in special schools at the moment. Neurodivergent children, I mean, would understand how that comes about because of the type of society we live in. Children with special needs. Schools our children with special needs are in dire straits. We must come again and talk just about that and definitely invite the people that work in that sector. Mm. But their infrastructure, and most of those schools have been converted into boarding schools because government is trying to shave off the costs of specialized equipment to transport learners, X, Y, and Z. And there's just very poor political will around making our traditional schools more inclusive.
Mm.
And so while that's happening, the actual infrastructure that exists is in an appalling condition. Mm. The norms and standards of school infrastructure feel inapplicable to these schools. Children are sleeping on tiny, tiny old mattresses, if anything at all. There isn't water in these schools. The buildings are dilapidated. They're typically in far-flung places of our community. I mean, if someone can tell me, if you regularly walk past a special school, that would be something, you know, they typically are shoved away in parts where society cannot ordinarily access these environments. And so what we are also concerned about is how explicitly the language invites the promotion, so that we can all monitor it happening, of creating an inclusive education system. And I think rightfully so, and we'd absolutely be in solidarity with any action that's taken to have government truly consider its position on that.
And lastly, let's talk about the accommodation of religion in school codes of conduct.
So the other thing that's happened, I can remember when these conversations were happening inside the portfolio committee, for example, of education in parliament, is that some of the parties that were most nervous about these introductions of the clauses were the ACDP. And the idea that we're watering down codes of conduct to not allow some schools to choose to be religion-based. Mm. And what the law is simply saying is that we're not creating circular schools here, but we need to create schooling environments that allow for all the different kinds of spiritual and religious beliefs to be in existence inside of that schooling environment. And so the idea of calling yourself a Christian school shouldn't mean that you're anti something else. Hmm. But we know that the current practice in our schools is that if you are not Christian, you're likely refused admission. Mm. And if you're not, you're bullied throughout your schooling career. Mm. And those are the things that we're trying to challenge school governing bodies to think broadly about and encourage HODs to also oversee and make sure that schools are in fact sticking to this idea that regardless of your faith base, you are entitled to an education. And I think that's these are the little things that have stirred or given fire to a small flame, really, around this bill, is the sensationalizing of ideas that government is trying to introduce sex education and do away with religion. All of those things that fearmonger change are truly regressive. And we must watch the institutions and the parties that spur on that kind of misinformation in our societies, because those shouldn't be the people that lead our country. And then we must be able to use platforms like these to call in, have conversations, write in. Let's talk more about what exactly people need to feel affirmed and at peace with the idea that this is a progressive reform. There are slight changes to different clauses in the system, but it truly is to make the system open and accessible to all, because at the moment previously, before the Bella Act came into play, there were parts of it that encouraged schools to make their own rules in ways that excluded others and or forgot some learners, when I think about the learners in schools for special needs.
Nonqedo, we're indebted to you. Thank you. Thank you so much for making time for us and to just really help us just grapple with this and really unpack it for us. Thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. Nonqedo Matube Dube is Equal Education General Secretary.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.